feel like this talk is actually really well planned. I'm glad to be going second. So I'm asking you to shift focus a little and go a little bit further upstream from our last presenter. So again, my name is Mayan. Today I'll be talking about the geospatial assessment of ambulance calls for opiate overdoses, particularly non-fatal overdoses, from 1 year before to 1 year after naloxone legislation went into effect in Oregon, and specifically in Multnomah County. And yes, I'm a fellow with no relationships to disclose. So, objectives for this talk today. I'm going to start by describing the background of opiates and naloxone in Oregon and in Multnomah County. I'll review methods for mapping opiate-related ambulance calls and identify next steps for future surveillance of opiate-related outcomes, particularly for use at the local level. So Oregon, like the rest of this country, has been facing an opiate epidemic, particularly with opiate analgesics, as you've just heard. And we know that with high rates of opiate analgesic prescribing, we have higher rates of fatal overdoses. Heroin, however, is also a problem in the Portland area and across the West Coast and the rest of the country. For those of you not as familiar with the West Coast, going straight from Mexico all the way up through California, Oregon, Washington to Canada is the I-5 corridor, which many of us know is very much a drug trafficking artery. We get most of our black tar heroin straight from Mexico. And so we have an issue with heroin in Oregon as well. Here's Oregon for you. With the arrow, you can see it's Multnomah County. I'm sorry, it's not showing up so great on this map. Multnomah County accounts for most of the Portland area, and Multnomah County has the second highest rate of opiate-related deaths in the state by county from 2009 to 2014, second only to Clatsop County, which is up in the northwest corner. They have a much smaller population, though, so we had over 700 opiate-related deaths in that time period. But just because we have the highest number of deaths in our county doesn't necessarily mean we are on a downward spiraling trend that the rest of the state is not. In fact, if we look at heroin death rates, this is based on medical examiner data, our heroin death rates have been dropping since 2011. So we went from 12.7 deaths per 100,000 people to 7.4, while the rest of our state has remained pretty steady, and the rest of the country has continued to see a slight rise in heroin-related deaths. What I find interesting, though, is that this trend does not hold true for, prescription-related deaths. Prescription opiate deaths in our county have been slightly on the rise, for the most part holding steady, like the rest of the state and similar to the rest of the country. And there's a number of reasons we can get into this, why we're seeing this trend, but I'm going to focus on one that was briefly mentioned in our last conversation, and that is naloxone. I'm assuming most folks in this room are familiar with it, so the 5-cent description is naloxone is an opiate antagonist that when given to somebody who's overdosing on opiates will clear the opiate receptors in their brain and restore breathing in a matter of seconds or minutes. So think Pulp Fiction almost. You know, they can go from not breathing and blue to breathing and having a conversation and very much suffering the symptoms of withdrawal. Now, as more states across the country start to pass legislation allowing for naloxone to be carried by lay individuals, the more we see those specific communities finding a reduction in their opiate-related deaths. And that's one of the major ways we are assessing the influence of naloxone across the country. This isn't a new drug, by the way. It's been around since about the 70s. So in July of 2013, on the 9th, the naloxone legislation in Oregon went into effect, and within 4 hours, we started training folks in our county in how to use naloxone. And on the right here, you'll see the kits that are currently distributed through one of our partner sites. So what I find challenging is when we talk about opiates and we talk about naloxone legislation, which is a huge part of our opiate response in this country, most of the research focuses on fatal overdoses because, frankly, they're pretty easy to study. We have medical examiner data, we have death certificates, so most of the research is looking at that really downstream measure of is naloxone working. Kind of makes sense, though, when you realize that naloxone itself is very much a harm reduction effort that's right at the end of our prevention spectrum. So for this project here, we wanted to look a little further upstream and to think about how naloxone might be influencing people who aren't dying from overdoses, who still have a chance to survive beyond this analysis. So in order to do that, we had to figure out how do we identify people who aren't necessarily being reported to us. And the truth is there's no way to capture every person who's overdosing. Someone can overdose on opiates and still completely survive without intervention of any kind. However, there are people who overdose who survive with intervention, and that is what we had to target for this analysis. So in Oregon, and particularly in Multnomah County, we focused on ambulance data. These are individuals who called or had someone call for them when they were overdosing, and that's the source of this analysis and this data. We started with July 9th, that's the day that naloxone training went into effect in Oregon, and we went 12 months forward and 12 months backward to start looking at change. This is where it gets tricky. American Medical Response was an incredible partner on this project, and we worked with a data analyst and a quality improvement specialist who used to be an EMT to come up with a query to pull all of these cases. So we have a huge batch of ambulance calls from this 24-month period, but there's no fancy checkbox that says this was an opiate overdose, this was a heroin overdose. We had to pull that really just from the text. So using text queries in SQL, we came up with this sort of flow. So I'll kind of walk through it for you. First and foremost, you have your top box. These cases, in order to be considered an opiate overdose, a non-fatal overdose, had to have one of these first three items true: a toxicological impression that included illegal drugs or prescription medication referencing narcotics, or a patient complaint involving overdose or drugs, or in the narrative, it had to list a specific drug or the word opiates. Now, this is the first time we've ever done this, and so we actually hand-sorted to make sure that our query worked effectively. When we do this the next time, we'll probably hand-sort again to make sure our query still holds. So for cases that met this first level of the definition, we went ahead and asked the next step, which is naloxone. We know that if naloxone is given to somebody who's not overdosing on opiates, let's say it's benzodiazepines, it will do nothing. It's like injecting saline into the body. So if someone improves and starts breathing again after they've been given naloxone, we know that it's an opiate overdose, almost certainly, because it doesn't affect you in any other way. So if someone is given naloxone and they improved and they met one of those first three definitions, they counted for our study. However, in some cases, someone might be given naloxone and truly be overdosing on opiates and not improve. That might be somebody who has a really high level of opiates in the body, and a single dose may not be sufficient to reverse the overdose. So we didn't exclude them from this study. We just went back and made them meet one other step, one other qualification, which was that in their patient complaint, it really needed to mention heroin or specific opiate or the word opiate. So our goal was to take this AMR data and to start looking at the geographical change throughout our county of calls from before and after the naloxone legislation went into effect. We certainly wanted to know if there were more calls or fewer calls, but we were curious if perhaps in the different areas where we were doing naloxone training, if we were seeing a change in the distribution and in the concentration of calls. But we wanted to first sort of frame this for ourselves and think about what a change in calls might actually mean. So we thought about who are our potential callers. These are opiate users, or the people who would call on their behalf. And we thought if we see an increase in one area or a decrease, perhaps it's related to a change in calling habits or patterns. Maybe there is a general distrust in the community that has been amplified by media coverage or certain stories that are going around anecdotally between individuals, or a fear of calling the police or calling 911, fear of being prosecuted for having drugs on the person. It could also be a change in what actually triggers a call, which would be the drugs themselves, perhaps a change in the formulation of the prescription opiate analgesics, or perhaps it could be a change in drug trafficking trends. Maybe the big cartel in town was taken down and now there's not as much heroin in the community. That might change the number of calls we're getting. It could also be a change in the population itself. Maybe there's more people in one neighborhood using drugs than there were before, or maybe there's a drug-using community that has shifted to one area or another. And then finally, naloxone could certainly have an influence, as when we are training people, we're constantly telling them to be calling 911, that it's really part of our state statute that in every training we tell people to call 911 if they're using naloxone, just in case somebody relapses. So again, we wanted to think about what we might be seeing. There's certainly some other options for what might explain an increase or a decrease. So first and foremost, we ran our data from AMR, and we ended up in our pre-year with 433 non-fatal overdose calls, and 545 in the second year, a 25% increase from one 12-month period to the next. So we saw an increase here, and we weren't really sure what to expect, if it would be an increase or a decrease, but this one was pretty hefty. And we had to figure out why. So we started thinking, and we first hypothesized that maybe it was a change in AMR practices. Maybe ambulances were coding their data differently, and the EMTs were responding differently. Maybe calls to the ambulance service were being responded to in a different way now that they weren't before. None of these things were true, but that was hypothesis one. Hypothesis two is a lot more likely. And what we believe is that there were more potential callers. So we know that our syringe exchanges in this 12-month period and in the months prior as well saw an increase in the number of new clients actually coming in and signing up at the syringe exchange. And when they sign up, we ask them the simple question, what's your primary drug of preference. Now, this can certainly change over time as people move from one drug to another, but heroin or other prescription opiates have also been on the rise with our syringe exchange clients, particularly the new ones as well. So we like to think that this might just be attributed to an increase in the number of callers, though again, it could be another reason behind this. So MAPS, many of you are probably here, maybe some of you, for the MAPS. So we initially intended to do some significance testing, looking at changes in the geospatial distribution of calls within our county, but we found that with only 2 years of data, we were actually pretty limited in the tools that we could use. We spoke with the folks at ESRI, we used ArcGIS, ArcMap, and we were instructed to focus on more descriptive tools for this study. In future, we hope to be able to do a little bit more with the significance testing. The reason that we were limited to 2 years, by the way, is because AMR coding for naloxone use and the way it affects the body if someone improves or not changed in the middle of 2012. So we were stuck and couldn't go back any further than 12 months. Going forward, in fact, not so long from now, we'll be able to pull another year of data and do some more testing. So for this study, we used kernel density, or heat maps, and census block groups. And I'll show you these two different sets of maps. For each, we have pre-calls, post-calls, again using that July 9th date, and then a difference between the two. And for my ArcMap and GIS friends, we used the spatial analyst extension, the kernel density tool, we took XY event locations to build heat maps that showed concentrations of calls. We used our standard county radius, which is about 1 mile, that's what's used for all of our maps, and then we subtracted our pre-raster from our post-raster to show difference in pixels within the area. Did that make sense to anyone? Okay, good. I see some nodding. That's good. That makes me feel good. I felt like it was gibberish, but I liked it. All right. So moving on. This is our first pre-map here, and this is a kernel density heat map. So for those of you who are not familiar with the Portland area, the part that's an inset with the black box, that's downtown Portland. And what I want to point out to you, that dark spot in downtown, it's highly residential, but it's really more business. It's not highly residential. It's much more business. And there are many homeless camps in this part of the city, lots of bridges, and lots of social service agencies. So we weren't too surprised to see a really high concentration of calls in this pre-year in that area. The other dark orange areas out east, or the lightish orange areas, are all falling along our major arteries. It's a little hard to see, but there's a green line going out that is our light rail. And you'll notice the pattern again follows those major traffic patterns, the easy pedestrian travel as well. If we compare it to our post year, you'll look at the downtown inset and you'll see that darkest circle has grown. So looking just at these heat maps, it suggests that we're seeing the most concentration for our new calls or our increase in calls in the downtown area. But it's a little hard to compare across these two maps. You can see further out in the eastern part of our city and towards the eastern part of our county that there are more areas reporting any calls than there were in the past. Some reported none that are now reporting some. But it's a little hard to tell in real detail which areas are of highest concern. So instead, we decided to focus on looking at the difference between the two on one map, which we thought would be a little easier. And I'm more fond of this map personally. If we look at the downtown area, you'll see sort of that kidney red shape. And that certainly shows that the primary increase in the number of calls, that's why it's red, happened in the downtown area and up in northwest downtown Portland. But then right in the northeast part, it looks kind of like it's going right over the river. It's blue. You can see that in the inset, which suggests a decrease in the number of calls. Looking at this map, we know it's happening somewhere in this northeast area, but you can't really pinpoint exactly where, which we found a frustration with this map. And I think going into this, we thought this map would be a little bit more useful using the kernel density. In fact, we found it a bit frustrating. You can see looking out east, by the way, that increases and decreasing patterns are all happening along, I think you can see it better, the green max line and some of our other main roads. So I'd like to shift focus for a moment now to the census block group maps, which I personally find a little bit more helpful. So these help us identify a little bit more in detail which block groups are actually seeing calls. Unfortunately, census block groups are somewhat arbitrary, same like census tracts. They don't necessarily have any indication of the social factors behind that area, which is why a heat map might be better. But in this case, what we're finding the higher call volumes are certainly downtown. There are some more hot spots further out in the eastern area. And if we compare it to the post map, you're seeing more block groups reporting any call than in the past reported none. So similar trends that we saw before. But I think actually the most exciting map of all is where we actually look at the difference between the two. because if we look at one to the other, we can see there might be an increase. It's hard to really assess decrease with this sort of mapping style. So keep in mind, this is us trying to figure out the methodology we want to use in future at the county level to drive our practice. This map is my favorite, and I think you can see the colors all right. Okay, let's see how I want to tackle this one. So if we start with downtown, you'll notice right along that river, if you look at the inset, there's a few red block groups. There, well, Portland, for those of you who haven't been, is also known as Bridge City. We have a number of bridges which provide shelter to a lot of homeless camps in the downtown area, which is why we see right along that waterfront a lot of overdose calls. This is because we know a lot of drug use, drug sales happen in this area under the bridges, in the homeless camps. Even folks who don't live in homeless camps are reporting to us that they often go to these areas to use opiates in our community. If you look sort of to the northwest, there's a little highway sign that says 405 and sort of a vertical block group that's red. This is an interesting one. This is called the Pearl District in Portland, and it's a little bit to the side. It's less, a little more industrial, not as much foot traffic, not as much car traffic, but there's also a highway overpass that goes all throughout this block group, and underneath it is a tremendous amount of somewhat semi-sheltered space. So because of that reduction in traffic and because of an increase in the number of efforts by local police and security to clear out the waterfront every morning, we're actually seeing a lot of our homeless population shifting up into this part of the downtown area, which is why we suspect that we're seeing an increase in calls. What we also found interesting is there's a green district that kind of runs horizontally right in the middle of downtown. And it just runs along the waterfront on its short edge. There's actually a lot of social services agencies right there, and we thought we'd be seeing a lot more calls in this area. Remarkably, we weren't. Which brings me sort of to the next question, which is the blue, dark blue districts, which show a reduction of at least 5 to 13 calls from in this period. So we wanted to look at that specific block group and the block groups in those areas to understand why. And what we found was that one of them actually had 13 fewer calls in this time period, which was pretty hefty for our area. The drop was specifically seen at one homeless shelter. Looking at the heat maps, we couldn't figure that out, but here we were able to see it happened at one homeless shelter. So we contacted the shelter to see if there was any change, perhaps in any of their drug policies, and in fact, there wasn't. There was still a no drug use policy in place. But they did know that some of their residents in their private rooms or in their private apartments were still using drugs. We also knew from speaking with our syringe exchange staff that many residents at this homeless shelter had undergone naloxone training at some of our syringe exchange sites. So it could mean a few things. It could mean that people who are trained in naloxone and in a high concentration at the shelter are saving lives, using their naloxone, saving a life, and then not calling 911, even though they're instructed to do so during their training. It could also mean that there's fewer drug users at the shelter, which is not what we're hearing from the staff. Or perhaps it could mean that people are coming for naloxone training, they're becoming more aware of opiate overdoses in general, and then they're less likely to overdose in this population. Without doing a really detailed interview survey process with this population at this shelter, it's a little hard to interpret. But regardless, what we're thinking is the only change that really happened in this time period that affected this population was the rollout of our naloxone program. So this is something that we're going to hopefully be looking into a little bit more. And just to show you a little bit more on East County, or the eastern part of our city here, there's two block groups I want to point out that are blue, just kind of hanging out there in the middle. These are interesting. These two block groups had at least 6 to 10 calls in the first 12 months and then dropped to none. And this is, again, just a 12-month period. And it shows how interesting and detailed these maps can really be in informing us, because what it might be is an example of one or two people in these districts who repeatedly called because they were overdosing repeatedly. And ultimately, one of them may have stopped using drugs, might have moved, or sadly might have died, so that the individuals who are driving those numbers up no longer are there driving them. So there's a lot of different ways to interpret it. We also have a triangular sort of red district there as well, right near that Highway 84 sign. We have a hospital right there, another highway overpass, and it's also on public transit lines. So again, interesting and tricky to interpret these maps overall. The two different types of maps we looked at, they both can be pretty helpful. We found sort of at quick glance the block groups may be more helpful, but the heat maps give us some broader trend information that we can't get by looking just at block groups. So quickly, I want to touch on limitations. I mentioned we were limited to 2 years of data, so we were using descriptive methods this time, but we have set this framework and we now have a baseline to which we can compare all of our future efforts on looking at the geospatial change of our ambulance calls down the road. So what are these maps actually telling us? I think that's what I found the most interesting, and that, frankly, it's that calling patterns are changing. There's not much more a map can tell you. You have to take that map and overlay it with other data sources. And I think Dagan left. He works at the Oregon Health Authority, but he's one of our wonderful resources who we can speak with about other data sources as well. So in Multnomah County, at the local level, we want to look at rapidly available data, or at least quickly available data, so we can start to inform our public health practice, to inform our harm reduction efforts, our needle exchange folks, the people who are working on the streets doing, police officers and first responders, so they know what areas might be higher risk at what times of day. And by using different data sources, like medical examiner data, we can start to understand what these maps are telling us a little bit more. We can start to overlay where deaths are happening and where the non-fatal overdoses are happening. We can look at police reports to get rapidly available information, needle exchange enrollment surveys. The reversal reports for naloxone are fascinating. Anytime someone wants to refill that kit of naloxone, they come in and they fill out a form where they talk about, how did they use that naloxone? On whom was it used? Where was it used? Did they call 911? And again, starting to get location information from these individuals when it's available, which can be tricky, can be very helpful if we start to compare that to where our non-fatal overdoses are happening. Also, there's addiction treatment data and prescription drug monitoring data as well from the state health department. So again, local level response to opiates is a major concern in the Oregon area and in Multnomah County and Portland, and I know it is across the country. And one of our, I think, most exciting efforts has been to look at the intersection of all these different data sources and how we can use them to help inform our response to the opiate epidemic in our area. I'd like to thank my primary mentor, Amy Sullivan, who's sitting here in the audience. A lot of our other partners at Multnomah County, our IT specialist, Ben Harper, who helps a lot with maps, outside in, and our American Medical Response team as well. And that is all. Yes, please.
Thank you. I enjoyed the presentation. And I guess the question I have a little bit is, well, I have two, but the first one is, if there were 400 calls in the year before and then 500 the next year, and then looking at some of those maps, you know, there's a lot of block groups.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like maybe some of those numbers have gotten spread out, and maybe it's a function of maybe small numbers, some of those changes and differences. Did you try to factor in any of those things? Or?
So we didn't factor it into these maps. So we did look at using just census block groups, and sorry, not blocks, excuse me, census tracts, and looking at different ways to actually slice and dice our county. We tried using k-means so we could look more at the larger trends. And you're right, there is some of it is variation that is so small it's kind of hard to capture here. So it's a tricky question. If you have suggestions, I'd actually love to hear them because I think it might be help us with local practice. But that doesn't really answer your question, but it's a great comment.
Does this data include private ambulances, or are they just
This is just American Medical Response, just the one service, but they do the majority of responding in the area. Mm-hmm. The other group are our fire, our local fire department, but the way that it works is if fire arrives on scene and AMR arrives afterwards, they actually transfer to AMR, so they should have everyone on record who they're responding to. Did you have a second question, by the way?
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, our experience in North Carolina is we passed out like 10,000 kids and had 500 reversals, but there's a lot of people who don't show up and they don't call for medical assistance. We're seeing more and more of that. And, you know, even though it states very clearly in all of the instructions, the first thing you're supposed to do is call 911. You know, so there's a lot of kind of treat and just move on.
So we've had this problem too. I'm curious, do you all have a Good Samaritan law in place in North Carolina?
Yeah. People are still, at least they told us that they're still afraid of it. It doesn't, you know, protect all people, or they don't think it protects all people, or there's different amounts.
So I think we're going to face the same problem. Our Good Samaritan law, which protects people from being prosecuted if they call 911 and have drugs on their person, it was just signed into law a week and a half ago. It's taken quite a while, and I don't think we are ready necessarily or prepared to approach that question and how we're going to deal with it. At the moment, the reason people aren't calling is exactly what you're saying. It's fear of being arrested for having drugs on their body, and knowing the quantities is also a big question. I don't really know how we're going to handle it down the road, but I hope that we can look to you all for ideas since you're further down the chain. Yeah, Zach.
You might have gotten this at the beginning. The definition of a reversal, in Marin County, California, we're also tracking naloxone use, and one thing we found is that it's because of the high prevalence of opiate use, and also the comorbidities in that population, those events that lead to altered mental status may be coincident with opiate intoxication, for which naloxone might lead to a change in their status, but if not, might not actually be a quote-unquote life-saving or even meaningful intervention, but might be interpreted as a reversal because it led to a change in status.
Right.
Has there been any effort to try to sort of define what a meaningful reversal event is?
It's a great question. So I'll rewind back to just how we've been defining opiate-related events in general. And at least in the Multnomah County area, the general feeling between our health officers, our medical examiners, and at least at the county level, is that we care if opiates are involved at all, if they're the primary cause of death or the primary cause for the ambulance call, or if it's an underlying or contributing cause. We care regardless, because it's still an opiate problem in the community. So it is important to certainly understand and separate, but for the work that we're doing, if opiates are involved, it's still telling us that opiates are in the community. It's helping us understand where and when. So we're not necessarily trying to differentiate at the moment, but it's certainly something we could look at.
It's just probably worth making sure that we're not always assuming that a naloxone-based reversal saves a life.
Right, and I guess at this... What I wanted to focus on here is we're not thinking so much about saving lives at the moment, because as I said at the beginning, I'm not sure if you were here, most research really does focus on the fatal overdoses, and we're trying to put that aside for a moment and think about the non-fatal overdoses that really may not have ended up in a fatal in a fatality anyway. The idea is simply this is someone who's a little bit less likely to overdose or who has the habit of calling. There's a lot of ways to interpret it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chris Ryan from Brewer County, New York, medical director of the County Health Department and of our three county EMS system. Do you know what happened to your total EMS call numbers during that period of time?
I don't offhand.
Globally or spatially?
Offhand, I cannot remember. I looked at it, and I'm sorry, I didn't put it in the presentation.
And it can make it useful to nominate it for these sorts of things.
That's a great way to look at it, yeah.
And do your law enforcement officers carry any last one?
Not yet. We have a pilot group in the Portland area that is starting. There's going to be about 12 officers, I think. They've either been trained or they're being trained soon. There's actually been a lot of pushback from our officers in the community who haven't been wanting to get trained. They're concerned about safety. They're concerned about compensation, a number of other factors. There are other areas in the state that are also looking into it as well.
And last question. do your patient care reports from AMR capture medication administered before their arrival?
No, and that has been one of our largest frustrations. So if it's naloxone, the person who perhaps gave naloxone, let's say it's a friend, and then called 911 and then bolted because they were afraid the police is coming, they're not there to report, and certainly the person who's overdosing, even if they've been revived, is probably not going to say anything or is so disoriented and uncomfortable with withdrawal symptoms that they're not mentioning it. This has been a question that the AMR quality improvement specialists locally are working on, but there's currently no mechanism to capture it, and it would be inconsistent even if they did. But if you are you doing that locally?
Well, yeah, our law enforcement officers carry intranasal naloxone. Mm-hmm. Of course, all of our EMS agencies, pretty much always ALS response, have been carrying naloxone for a long time. And NEMSIS has a field for medication administered before arrival. I've been having a hard time getting our agencies to use it consistently, so when our law enforcement officers use intranasal naloxone, reverse it, that goes on their form. That never shows up in the PCR database, so if the medic is not recording that as medication given for arrival, when I go to pull up EMS runs involving naloxone administration, those cases don't get consistently captured because that field not being consistent. It's something we're working on.
Yes,
however. Get the EMS providers to use that more consistently.
We have a wonderful EMS director in our area who's been trying to figure out how we should be tracking opiates better, John Ju, and that's probably a conversation we should be having, I think, across local jurisdictions, because it's a challenge that would probably help drive a lot of our efforts.
You can do pretext searching narratives.
But it's tricky.
The beauty of the naloxone is it's a defined field. It's unambiguous.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unambiguous until you get to the law enforcement naloxone, the friends and family naloxone.
Yeah.
Is that recorded?
Exactly. Thank you. I think I saw a question over here, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
I have a question. First of all, congratulations on getting the good exam law passed. That's really exciting.
Yay!
My question was, so the last comment you made in your talk was about the implications of this kind of mapping, and I'm wondering, as you go, once you have these maps and as you go into the future, what implications are there for policy and naloxone implementation, and how are you going to use the map? Like, what is it going to mean to you?
So initially, when we started this project back a while ago, maybe a year and a half ago, our Good Samaritan law had not passed. The bill was still being fought for quite strongly. So I actually thought that this was going to be a good support for getting that bill passed. It actually passed almost unanimously just a few weeks ago, so it wasn't quite ready in time for that, remarkably. But now that it is available, I think we'll be able to use this same system to help evaluate how well that Good Samaritan law is actually impacting, or if it is impacting at all, calling patterns. But I don't think the maps will do it alone. I think we're going to have to overlay that with the work that we're doing with our syringe exchange, particularly with the reversal reports. And once we start talking to people and asking if they called and if they didn't call, why, we might be able to build into those surveys a question about the Good Samaritan law. And then we can start to map where those overdoses are happening and look at if these calls overlap. I think it's going to be a compilation of sources that will back up the strength of the bill and its effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.